And welcome to AMO Kenzoku episode 76. We are a group of four bubblegum crisis boomer otaku who wanted an excuse to talk about anime, manga, and any related subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hey, I'm Sam.
Hey all, I'm Mike.
Hello, I'm Nick.
And I am tonight's host, Dylan. This episode is being recorded on the 23rd of December, 2025. Today, we will be continuing discussing independent trips that Sam and Dylan took to Japan over November and December. With that, I say, Hashin! So, continuing from last time, we largely just discussed logistics of traveling. And we got to one that actually I was curious to come back around to was driving in Japan. And feelings of that. And I'll kind of start and see if anyone else has a different opinion or anything else. I've driven in the U.S. and I rented a car and drove around all of Ireland, North and Republic, and then Japan. I don't think I've really driven in any other. Oh, no, that's not true. I also drove in a third world country down in the Southern Caribbean. I did that. So one of the things is that in driving in the U.S., I hate it. It stresses me, freaks me the heck out. And I had a similar experience when I drove in Ireland. In Ireland, I was there back in 2019. But I think probably even more so in Japan, where some things were definitely stressful, of like going down, following Toyota's directions, going down a one-lane road that's maybe 1.25 lanes with 2 lanes of traffic possible, and, you know, wondering if someone's going to come around the corner. In a few places, someone did, and, you know, we kind of stopped and backed out and never got through fine. It wasn't a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in general, I found it way less stressful and way less just I'm on edge all the time. And I think some of it is that, you know, I was driving in a Prius, which over there is not a small car.
Yeah.
It's not huge, but it's not
a K car. So it's a standard vehicle, which is larger than basically every K car.
Yeah, like, so a Prius over there is probably in, like, I don't know, like, the 60th percentile for vehicle size. Like, it's, whereas in the U.S., driving a similar thing, and we drive, like, the compact SUV type thing. It's a Tesla Model Y. Like, driving that here, which is a bigger car than a Prius, I used to have a Prius. In the U.S., I feel attacked nearly all the time from giant trucks and vehicles and them, you know, tearing down and tailgating you all over the place and everything. Whereas in Japan, I really did not feel much of that. Like, yes, there are big trucks there, but they're trucks. But there was, at least my opinion, and this, I drove around Kyushu. I have not driven anywhere outside of Kyushu.
I'm interested to hear Sam's take, since Sam's the only other one, I believe, who's driven in Japan. I never have, so.
Finishing off my thoughts there. So aside from that, like, people generally did not tailgate such that when I was merging in or someone else was merging in, there was never any stressful amount of it. And no one zooping around anyone and sudden braking.
I think it's there's two major factors. And one is substantially, I would say, more influential. And the first is just cultural. Like, Japanese mm-hmm. people in general just do everything correctly, right? It's just, that's everybody. I would say driving is less, I mean, in Kyushu, it's probably more normal because there's way less, like, super expensive train systems, like in the Kanto area. But everybody who drives just generally drives, you know, within the regulated speeds and, you know, so let's call it a minimal amount of lane changing. And the other is just speed limits in Japan are way lower than they are way here in the States. Lower. Way yeah. lower. Like if you're if you're driving 65 kilometers an hour, you're going pretty fast. So, and that's what 45 mph here. Get rough back of the napkin math, maybe 40. So
I can let me yeah. So most roads over there, at least the ones that I saw, and I'll let Sam cut in here, were 50 kilometers. With highways being rated up to 80 or 100 kilometers an hour. One thing I will have to say, and Rebecca had said that she saw it in some of her podcast things, and it was definitely true, was that people over there did drive over the speed limit.
Oh, yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. regularly, if the speed limit was posted as, like, 80 on a highway road, like, people would generally be driving something around 90 kilometers an hour.
I think for highway that makes sense because it's just going to be way less monitored. But I think within city limits, it's like much stricter.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. My very limited city driving,
I Okinawa, at least, I was hyper aware of when people were going over the speed limit because I was just on a dinky electric scooter, and there were definitely people. I would be driving the speed limit. Like driving uncomfortably fast for my scooter, and people would still wanted to pass me. So there were only, you know, small regions where there was a very high speed limit, like 60, which is like the highest on my island. And yeah, people will drive fast, I think, if they have the opportunity to. But they're still very polite about it. It's just I would get anxious about somebody on my butt in a scooter.
What about on the bigger islands?
It was way too much traffic for that to ever be a factor. When I was on Naha, it was just traffic all the time, so speed just never factored into it.
Kind of like driving all around Honolulu. Well, probably not the same, but Honolulu, where it's like there's a speed limit, but it's 4 miles an hour because that's as fast as you can drive in Honolulu.
Yeah. I will say that while driving in general wasn't very stressful, like it was kind of stressful for me, and it wasn't from the driving part so much as the endpoints, and also narrow roads. The roads are way more narrow there.
That's, sorry to interject, that's been the main reason that I've have been hesitant to ever think about driving in Japan, because just I've seen so many, like, there's always so many roads where only one car can go by. Yeah. And it just works because, again, all Japanese people just have an understanding. Like, you figure it out and you make it work.
Yeah.
If that happened here in the States, there would just be nonstop gridlock and people screaming at each other and throwing tire irons through each other's windshields all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not even exaggerating, I feel like. I mean, granted, yeah, totally. I'm in California, which is like road rage central, but not trying to make it like a pissing contest. There's plenty of cities with terrible drivers here in the United States. I've experienced many of them.
Yeah, I mean, you grew up in LA, so
indeed. But I also just recently came from Boston, where I regularly was glanced. Maybe when I was getting out of my Ubers, I was like literally their cars blowing by me and giving me maybe like 4 inches of leeway. Like it was absolutely terrifying. So, yeah, I mean, the one thing is, I guess the main thing is just the narrow roads. It's more just, I don't trust myself enough. It's less about the people living there, more myself. And, I don't want to cause any sort of, accident or nuisance. But also just the concept of me driving in another country is already, like, I don't like driving at all.
Yeah.
So, there's the concept of driving, and especially when I'm supposed to be on vacation. It's like something like, I'd rather take a very roundabout route on buses and trains that maybe it doubles the time than thinking about getting a car. That's just my perspective, of course.
Yeah, I and there is another part to that was stressful, which is the beyond the narrow roads is at the end of the trip, finding a place to park and how you park is always a pain. There were very few times where it was... Well, I shouldn't say very few. It was frequently I had to think about, like, where am I going to park my car? And is it okay to park here? Like, and then you have the whole thing where the general culture there is you always back into your spot.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say, that's just the thing that would take me forever to do is backing into every single spot.
I mean, I had heard about the backing up.
I had heard the backing in things, so I've just been like practicing it and just doing it all the time. And now I'm addicted to it. And whenever someone doesn't do it now, I'm like, you fool. It's so much better.
It's infinitely easier if you have a backup camera with the lines. My Prius is like 1 year too old for that. So it's backup camera is an SD fisheye that kind of sucks.
Yeah. But when I was in Okinawa, there was nothing like, the great thing was I could just throw the scooter wherever, right? Like, you know, no parking space is fine. I'll just find a patch of grass.
That's true. That is one thing that Japan really just kind of tolerates is like the smaller form factor, like scooters and mopeds and stuff. Like people park them in random nooks and crannies and it just is okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No one ever gave me any trouble for parking my thing in a weird spot. Although I did feel guilty one time. I came to this is in Okinawa. I went to a juice stand and there was, you know, only a few parking spots and I didn't really see a good spot for my scooter. And so I just went way far away and parked like kind of off to the, just past like the last parking spot. And I think people didn't like me parking there as the lot filled up after I got there.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't think they think that spot stayed kind of open next to my moped. Yeah, it's not as stressful in some ways, but in other ways, it's definitely more stressful driving in Japan.
So I would say, like, if you're going somewhere and you're inclined to do it, like, I would say to give it a try and just be like, all right, let's do this here and pick it on a thing.
You can just do a day rental. Like, that's really common in Japan too, right? Just go pick it up for a day, go drive somewhere and then come back. So
definitely. Okay. I think one last thing kind of on that was just as a lesson learned by us and our attempting and trying to pre-plan and all these stops and stuff is like for any stop, particularly if you're out like driving somewhere and you're kind of like, oh, going around there, like give yourself like an hour for at least an hour for wherever you're thinking of stopping. Cause like just all these little places and nooks and crannies and things, like if it's something that's worth driving to at all, like it's going to be so much nicer than you think it is. And you're just going to want to spend more time. And then if you're like, oh no, we got to go to the next thing. So that was kind of a lesson that we learned and had to force ourselves to be like, oh no.
Yeah. Don't overschedule. It can be a problem. I did that when my first driving trip.
Yeah. It's really hard not to, cause there's so much to see and you want to do it. You know, it's not like you're out there all the time or anything. Mm-hmm. We ended up cutting out some things eventually. On the parking thing, I didn't feel like I had much trouble. There's a couple places I did some street parking that was fine and others parking lot. Probably the most stressful parking was in Beppu, which is like the hot springs town in northeastern Kyushu that has like the Seven Hells touristy hot spring things. And they're kind of cool, but like it was just madness. It was the only place I parked like front in because there was literally just not enough room in the lot and there was like buses and cars and everything there that I did not have I was way overstressed to be able to attempt to do a back in there, and it was the spot was just in front of me. I'm just like, no, I'm just driving straight in here. I don't care. And it was fine. And then when I left, the person after me, they tried to back in for a second. Then they're like, nope, screw it. I'm parking straight in too.
Vindicated. Yeah. I mean, the big touristy spots is generally fine. Like, cause there's lots of parking, but like it's the smaller places where you're going into a city or something like that, where there may not even be spots and you have to kind of drive around for something. Maybe even do the pay parking. That. Yeah. That's
okay. So let's get off of that kind of logistical fun stuff of that there. I want to talk about a kind of let's go to let's take this back to our AMO roots and talk about where one should go booming out and where one should not go booming out.
Here we go. This is where I think we're going to have some conflict finally.
Let's see here. I will say, having gone here, and like I said last time, I haven't really been to Japan in 20 years, nearly coming back. I would say, at least on the day that I was there, I think, as everyone else had said, like, I don't recommend go booming out in Akihabara.
I completely agree.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No disagreement there.
The Akiba that was glorified in our youth and our prime, let's call it, is dead and gone. COVID definitely killed whatever remained of it. But even pre-COVID, I would say, I mean, Sam, you were definitely there pre-COVID.
Yep.
And it was already, in your opinion, kind of on the outs at that
point,
too.
It was fading, right? But not the, I mean, the change is huge now these days.
It was.
So let me explain why I think you shouldn't go booming out in Akihabara. At least on the day I was there, because we only went there like one day for like a couple of hours, and we're just like, we're out. Like, it was a crazy busy day. I think it was a Saturday anyways. But there was just so many people, and it was it was 100% like tourists.
Yep.
And trying to get into Ragio Kaikan, I was like, I want to go Ragio Kaikan. It's a cool store. It's been a cool place forever there. Mm-hmm. Literally just getting in at the day I was there, there was quite literally a line to get on the elevator, getting up there. And then like, even on the upper floors, like you literally could not even walk around or even really comfortably look at, even comfortably like browse and look at anything and find stuff. Now, that being said, I did find some really cool stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
I did find probably the coolest set thing of this Eva room set, where it's like little miniature set of stuff from Eva. I'll send some pictures, but like it's all super crazy detailed, where it's like you literally like build yourself your own little micro scale Evangelion themed room inside of your Evangelion themed room.
I feel like anything Eva is just a cheat code for you though. Like,
yeah, it really is.
It could have been inside of an onsen, you know, town, and you would have been like, yeah, this is the best AMO hangout ever. So I feel like that's a little bit disingenuous.
I agree, and that's why I'm not giving it a pass. And because I did find a cool thing, but the experience of being there, and like my wife, who like she likes anime stuff, but she is not, she's like a level three,
mm-hmm.
like, and she was like, I need to not be here anymore.
Yeah.
And I didn't disagree with her. I was just like, oh my gosh, this is way too much. And then also like a lot of the other things that I think that I remembered enjoying, of like, it was always like a busy place there, but you could kind of like, you could walk around and you could browse and you could look at stuff and have fun. Mm-hmm. And then there was all the cool arcades and stuff. Now I think arcades in general are kind of dead everywhere.
There's only a few like very straggling arcades, as you know, I would say I would recognize them, which is, you know, with Candy Cabs and primarily fight, and they're almost all exclusively fighting game focused now.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, you know, there's only a couple left in Tokyo, and they're actually not, they're like in kind of like oddball spots, because, you know, everything fighting game related pivoted to net play, even in Japan now, so everybody just plays on PC net. Well, you know, that's just the nature of it, and that's okay. But I just hate how all arcades as we know it were replaced by just these oceans of claw machines.
Yeah And they don't even give out good stuff for the most part.
Well, some of them, well, the problem is the seasonal, right? Like, they do there's like the Sega and whatever, the Bandai branded ones that have like, oh, you can only get this figure in this period of time at these arcades, claw machines. Like, I hate that.
Yeah, but like, outside of those, right, it's like giant bags of potato chips, giant Pocky, like
the low hanging fruit, the stuff that you're supposed to win, and then like any of the premium figures, especially you're you know, unless you can't get lucky and you come across like a machine where somebody did most of the work already, you're sinking in probably, I don't know, 8,000 yen, 10,000 yen, just to, you know, and then by then it's like, well, and you can't buy these. Most of these things are exclusive to Claw Games, so you can't buy them unless you go to a secondhand shop.
Yeah. Yeah, secondhand shop, you can get them, but you never
or a convention dealer's room in the U.S.
Right, and then the markup is catastrophic when you get to the across the ocean, obviously. At least domestically, it's probably still not the worst, depending on what it is, if it's something super popular or not, you know? Like, I'm sure anything Uma Musume is just going to be expensive no matter what. But, I that's probably the thing that was the most sobering experience, is just how Akiba really is just, if it just doesn't feel special anymore. It's got, of course, it still has a high density of like specific shops, but they are just overloaded with tourists, and it just doesn't feel like Japan to me.
I would say, like, if you have a thing in mind and you know exactly what you want, it can be a place to fulfill your mission. Be overpriced there, but like it's like you can do some treasure hunting there if you know where to go, but I just don't like, you can do all that shopping. I think it's if you're willing to roll the dice a bit more and you go away from Akiba to like a Surugaya or any of those other secondhand shops outside of there, it'll be a much more enjoyable experience.
Yeah, I agree with that. The first place that I went that had, I was like, oh, this feels a little bit more like the Akihabara shops, was actually down in Osaka, in
Denden Town.
Yeah, Denden Town down there, where there's literally like within like a few block area, there's like eight different Surugayas along with like 85 card shops, like TCG shops, and lots of other related stores and stuff. So it ends up kind of being this big area where there's a lot of stuff. And so that was my feeling there. I think, Sam, when I said that, you had some counter feeling or something else.
Yeah, like it's there. And the last time I was there was, I think 2019. And it felt pretty dead then. And I mean, I went there a few different times while I was visiting. And there just wasn't, it didn't feel happening, like tons of closed shops. Like, I went to, you know, good old Anime Jungle, which I don't even know if it exists anymore. And like, I went in and I felt the same way about Nakano Broadway, which is like, it's a thing you hear about that being like super amazing. And you go there and it's kind of like, really, is this it? Like, I don't know. To me, it never really had a big pull. It was just kind of there. I probably felt about as good in Fukuoka, going to shops, that I did in Denden Town, because it boiled down to basically like Torino Ana Animate and like Melon Books, and I think half those places don't even exist anymore. Like you mentioned, Surugaya, which is like kind of taken up that mantle of used old stuff.
The Surugaya there, they had like seven different shops, and they had their different focus of things there. So I don't know. I didn't have that feeling of stuff being shut down. Maybe it's been a while since.
I would agree, because my wife and I went to both Akiba and Denden last year, and we both fully agree. Like, I wouldn't say that. I'm certainly not saying Denden is like, you know, matching the energy of old Akiba, far from it, but it was definitely way more happening than Akiba was when we went last year.
When you say that, you mean more like in terms of like good stuff to find and that, less crowd?
Yeah, so it was a combination of, I mean, the crowd was definitely less crowded, yeah, but it was more just the density of things that I would expect to find close together, I guess is the best way to describe it. So Akiba has like case in point, the Sega building is now like an electronics store. Like that used to be the biggest arcade in the city. It was what, like 10 floor arcade, and it's completely gutted now. Like, just Akiba is now, it still has hotspots, but it's not contiguous anymore, which is what made it so special, right? Was just blocks and blocks of all this otaku stuff, and now it's fragmented. I feel like Denden feels less like that. I mean, it still had a bit of it, but way less, I would say, fragmented than Akiba feels now, is kind of how I, my experience on it. And honestly, I mean, not to hijack, but my favorite I would say AMO experience last year was actually in Kitakyushu in Kokoro, where my cousin lives. And she's like, oh, there's this place called Aroru City, and it's like got manga stuff. I'm like, oh, cool. And it's basically a super gigantic mall, and like 85% of it is just all AMO stuff. Like, it has a Mandarake, it has... And that was where I was like, oh my, that's where I got my Eva shirt that I wore. Like, the top floor, just like, I could literally spend like 4 hours there just like looking at all the stuff. It was the only place that had a dedicated section for Made in Abyss. Like, it had, I would say, the hardcore otaku stuff that I was searching for the whole time. And it was like the very last city I was in.
It feels like the cool stuff is kind of spread out. Like, the Akiba's just...
Yeah, overdone. Like other cities in Japan, I think, have their own thing, and they, in my opinion, hold up just fine to, I would say, today's expectations. Like, yeah, there was also, you know, a bajillion trading card shops, because that's just the you know, current, I would say, cancer in this, and not just otaku culture. It's kind of superseded that, and it's like this big,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of what NFTs wanted to be, I feel like, but. No, I guess in essence, it's kind of the same thing. It's just a physical thing instead of a digital thing. But
yeah.
But yeah, I would say that the good side, I guess, is the ability to find some cool AMO kind of niche things is now easier nationwide. But there's no more mecca for it, is, I think, kind of my take. I don't know if that's how you feel, Dome.
I'd go with that. And I think I kind of agree with your take on Dan Town. And perhaps it was also because I went there after Akiba and I was just kind of like, oh, look, there's like a Sura guy. Oh, there's another one. I didn't actually realize where I was going to so much. So it was kind of, I kind of felt like, I was just like, oh, well, I wanted to go walk through here. And we were walking on our way down to Shinsekai anyways. So it was kind of like, oh, then it was like, oh, wait, there's another store. So it kind of felt like a nice surprise of being like, oh, this is cool. Okay. I don't remember there being a bunch of stuff closed or anything when I was there, so I'll take that as a good sign.
The other thing I think also is just the way Osaka is laid out is you can go from Dotonbori to Denden Town to Shinsekai all on foot. It's a bit of a walk, but it's all doable on foot. Mm-hmm. Where in Tokyo, you will have to keep hopping on the train because it's all... You know, everything is all over the place. So yeah. I think it just feels more like contiguous and it just feels more, I don't know, like touristy in a good way to be able to just walk.
Yeah, and that's definitely, that is what we did. We went from Dotonbori to Denden down to Shinsekai.
Yeah, and that occupies a good chunk of a day. I mean, you can really...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was pretty much our day in... Well, we started out in Osaka Castle, and then we went to Dotonbori and around, and then
that's literally the exact route we did. Yeah, so it's and it was, you know, we went during certain cherry blossom times. It was absolutely stunning, you know, walking everywhere. Mm. And Osaka, in my opinion, is just the best food you can get. Like, there's no bad food in Osaka. It's all my favorite food is West Japanese anyway. So we had all the best eats in Osaka as well. I mean, Dylan, you guys did much more. I would say. Pinky up gourmand kind of tour, so I'm sure you guys found some really, really good stuff elsewhere. But
we actually, the Osaka day, we didn't really have any food planned other than, so we got some takoyaki in Dotonbori, and then we stopped at this really nice cafe place, Sakimoto Bakery and stuff. It looks like one of those places where it's like they started out with like a little bakery, then they got popular and they like expanded, so now they kind of have like three different stores that are all like right across the street from each other. And they had some really good stuff there. I think that's the first place Rebecca got the Mont Blanc.
Oh,
the chestnut Mont Blanc. No. that she's now completely addicted to
the spaghetti looking stuff.
Yes. And then when we were down in Shinsekai, we went to a lovely place called Osho Kurabu, which has been around since like the 50s and is an old like kushikatsu place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kushikatsu is like big in Osaka, so that
makes sense. And it was a super nice place where, again, it's one of those things where like we were the only foreign tourists. Well, there was like one other table of foreign tourists that came in, but, you know, it's one of those things of like, you know, we try to find the places that are kind of like 80% locals, mm-hmm. something like that, is usually ends up being good.
So were you able to you know, flex what like Japanese you still recall, or did you solely just rely on pointing and using a translator?
No, I spoke Japanese pretty much the whole time, and I did a lot of translation back and forth.
Did you get Nihongo Jozu'd a lot by locals?
Well, that's actually interesting, because I had actually gotten, like, Nihongo Jozu, like, from pretty much, like, day one. I was like, oh, and after, like, a couple of days beyond that, I started getting people going, like, oh, Nihon ni hatarakimasu ka? Or Nihon ni sundemasu ka? Like, do you work in Japan, or do you live in Japan? Because they're like, oh, you don't really have an accent, and you're not talking like an idiot, so you might actually work or live over here, which I take that as a good sign.
Did you just give him the real answer of, yeah, otaku
desu? Pretty much. Generally be like, wow, how'd you learn Japanese? So I'd be like, Rudo ken no se desu.
Yeah, I will say the Nihongo Jozu bar is very low.
These days, yeah. I think because just, so many people are trying to, like, you know, work visa their way there from the West, so.
Yeah, I mean, like, all you have to do is, like, in have them be explaining something to you, and you say, hai, wakarimasu, and they'll be like, oh, Nihongo Jozu. Like, it's a ridiculous. To the point where you do have to be careful that, like, if your Japanese isn't decent, you could get yourself into some trouble by them thinking that you are better than you are.
No more than you actually do, and then you end up, yeah, screwing up. Yeah, that's definitely, yeah. I definitely got into a couple of, I wouldn't say anything notable, but I think just because there's some vocab that went mm-hmm. above my head, and I missed a couple of details. But I still, you know, generally speaking, it's a non-issue for me.
I mean, the hardest thing for me was the, mumbling and like
mm-hmm, a lot yeah of, the people who don't enunciate clearly, who are yeah. not necessarily in the service sector. Yeah, I agree.
Like 90% of, like, it's something you take for granted in your day-to-day, like, just in even in English, that a lot of our life is built around language patterns, and so mm-hmm. you know, when you go and a thing happens, somebody's going to say a certain thing, and like the thing that gets me, I feel like I forget this all the time, is the, now when you buy something at like a konbini, they ask you if you want a plastic bag, and you know, what is it, rejibukuro, mm-hmm. and
yeah.
I'm like, they're mumbling this thing, and oftentimes they're wearing a mask, and I'm like, I don't know what they're saying, and so they have to point, and it's like, oh, that, and like, eventually I learned the pattern, so I knew what they were saying and everything, but that can be very frustrating, like, even if you know everything.
Well, the other thing is, a lot of konbini clerks, at least in Tokyo, are not even ethnic Japanese oh, yeah. speakers anymore. Like, they're, I would say at least half of them were Southeast Asian, and their Japanese yep. is fine. Like, I, yep. I can definitely communicate. What's funny is, a lot of them have better English, so they end up preferring tourists because they can just say it in English better, which I yeah. thought was common, especially if the ones that were, like, Filipino, definitely. Mm-hmm. Seemed like it was easier in English, and they were confused when they saw myself, me and my wife, and I was speaking in Japanese, so they defaulted to Japanese. But
yeah,
but yeah, that's a different, wholly different topic. That's more of a geopolitics thing, which is definitely yeah. not AMO. So let's go back to fun stuff.
Yeah.
So let's talk about another. So it feels like I had another great AMOing out, which was in Fukuoka at the I forget the name, but like the big mall there, and they have the Namco Bandai Cross store and the Gundam base.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like expanded out, so there's like a candy, it's like this big almost like kind of like open kind of store mall where there's like four or five kind of different store areas in there, including like a dagashi, like a candy shop, and then they had a bunch of stuff there. And it wasn't, I think there was a Tsurugaya there. Oh, there was a Tsurugaya in the mall, not attached to that store, obviously, but they had a bunch of really cool gear there. Like the craziest thing I got was they had a phone holder case, I still got to get it hooked up, from Infinite Revias, where it's like the VHS cover of Vol 9 as a phone cover.
The fact that Infinite Revias merch of any sort exists in a store in the year 2025, even if it's exactly. Japan, is like literally like a miracle.
That's insane.
So
So that's why I was like, what? And then the Gundam store was super cool, and they had obviously had a bunch of Gunpla that was all dressed up for Christmas season with like extra bling on the Gundams and everything. So it was a super cool store. Definitely, if you're in Fukuoka and you need to AMO out a little bit, I wasn't quite sure, and then went there and I'm like, oh, actually, this is really fun. They had so much cool stuff. They had like a Macross whole setup thing there, and then also at the main Hakata train station in Fukuoka, just literally like 2 weeks ago, a Nintendo store opened there. So we walked up, we're like, oh, maybe we can see. And like, as we walked in, we're like, yes. And there's a 2-hour line to get in the lottery line to get in the store. Got it.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yikes.
So no, we didn't do that. But we found other stuff to do. So that was a nice surprise in Fukuoka there. So it sounds like between that and then Kita Kyushu of that Aru City, northern Kyushu has some good AMO spots in it.
Yeah, Kokura. Well, because Kokura is Leiji Matsumoto's like hometown, so it's interspersed throughout the city on benches. Like there's like random Leiji Matsumoto characters like Herlock and, you know, Emeraldus and stuff. So that's definitely going to be a place I highly recommend Mike to visit whenever we can get him back over there.
For sure.
That sounds nice.
I would say Kyushu's AMO game is massively leveled up in the last 2 decades. Honestly, I think you can get your AMO fix exclusively in Kyushu, even because they have a Gundam base there, like you said, in Fukuoka, and Kita Kyushu has Aruoru City, so... Yeah, like I said earlier, I think it's just kind of the overall access to anything AMO now is almost any of the major islands you can get it, I think.
Yeah.
Where do you go to AMO out on Shikoku?
That's actually a good point. I've actually never been to Shikoku, so I couldn't say.
I think, Sam, you've been there.
Yeah, I was only in the... there's only like one major city there, isn't there, right? Like, I was in... What's the name of that place?
Well, there's eastern side has Kochi, and then the western side has Matsuyama. That's kind of...
Just follow Suzume's trip through Shikoku, and that'll get your tour of Shikoku.
Oh, yeah. Kochi is the one that I was thinking of. Yeah, I guess
that's
Matsuyama.
Like the major, major eastern city.
Yeah, that's the one. My brother and his wife were like, when I was staying with them, they were like trying to figure out, you know, what do you want to do? There's like there's nothing here. So what do you want to do? We went and saw the castle. Like, you want to go see the, what is it? Sakamoto Ryoma statue, the pistol guy. They're like, that guy's cool, right? You want to go see him? Not really. I don't care. It's just a statue. I'm sure they've got some AMO stuff there. I mean, they've got the usual used stores everywhere, like you say, so
exactly.
Maybe not the big district like you do in Kyushu and Osaka, but there's stuff.
I know. I think these days used secondhand stores have gotten so comprehensive in what they carry. Like, you can kind of get it. That's why Aruoru City was so great. It was just a single building, but it had everything that I could possibly think of that you need for ammo. It even has a dedicated floor for like collab stuff. So when we went, it was like the Demon Slayers promo, so they just had standees of all the Demon Slayers characters, and I realized, I guess they're all really designed after period accurate Japanese people, because they're all like 4'10" high. Like, they were all so short. I'm just towering over them. Like, these are literal children. And then they had like the bocce thing, so it was definitely nice to have just everything right there, and I didn't have to walk, you know, across oceans of people, and you know, it wasn't laden with tourists.
When I was in Matsumoto and I was just trying to find my hotel, because there were like three of the same hotel for some reason, there was a
also very Japan.
Yeah, very dread for sure, for reals. There was I just wandered by the Tsurugaya in Matsumoto. I was like, oh, okay. So I went over there to kill some time one day, and it was awesome. Yeah, there was tons of stuff in there. They had like two floors. They had a bunch of like, I was looking at like their retro game stuff, and tons of like boxed games, fully boxed games for very reasonable prices. I ended up buying a Secret of Mana boxed copy for 700 yen.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like in box, nice. Complete in box.
Yeah, complete in box. It was crazy. That's they had like two of them.
That's like a $250 like American purchase if you can find a complete in box North American version.
And you know what? Like I don't like the, I mean I obviously played the American versions growing up of these games, but like the packaging is so much nicer in the Japanese version.
Oh
versions.
Man, Japanese box art was king in the 90s. Yeah. Like nothing in the US touches it. Nothing.
Yep. It's gorgeous. So yeah, definitely Tsurugaya, man. That's the place to go. Like if it's you can't lose if you find one of those.
Hmm. Yeah. I would have to agree. So, Dylan, I know I don't want to jump too much, but since, you know, we don't have infinity time, I really want to hear your take on Ghibli Park because, you know, I had pretty strong opinions about it last year. So, and, you know, I hope that they didn't affect your and your wife's perception of it when you guys went. But what was your overall experience like there?
I thought it was pretty great. I think, well, let's hear. One, we were just there for one day, like, in and out, and we ended the day going back to, back down to Nagoya and then hopping on the Shinkansen to Kyoto.
Gotcha.
So we were there for one day. I thought it was really cool. I think it's very interesting that it's such an anti-Disney park in that there's no real like rides. Like there's a couple of small little like carousel type things, but it's all like in the experience. And I love that it's so tactile. Like you go into like Kiki's room and like her radio is there.
I was talking about that. Like, whoa, it's playing the.
With a place from your kind of yours, and I think some other recommendations, like we did not go out to Mononoke Village.
Okay. Yeah. It's probably the single, I mean, I think that was what soured it so much for me was obviously Mononoke is my absolute favorite Ghibli property, and the Mononoke Village was by far the most, I would say, disappointing. And that, I think, put me in a down mood for a lot of up until, and again, I don't want to take away your experience, but until we got to Mimi Osumasaba, like the workshop, and then that's when it turned up for me, was that whole section to me was like the best part of the whole park.
Yeah, it was really cool. I think my favorite was Satsuki and Mei's house.
That one was pretty great too.
Totoro.
Yeah, it was a hike to get there though. Like you felt like you were going out into the boonies to get there, because it was like a 2 kilometer hike or something.
I don't know if that there was several different routes you could take to walk to get over there, and it was like, well, if you're willing to go up and down a little bit. Plus we were there in the fall, so it's not like it was like 85 degrees out and we were sweating it out to get over there. I think if that had been the case, we would have been more, maybe more upset or felt more immersed in getting out to the house out in the boonies. But I thought it was really cool there. The other thing, like that, you know, it's kind of funny, like we just planned on not doing the picture with no face because that... They have like 13 or 15 different kind of setups where you can take pictures of yourself in movie scenes and stuff. And like, if you don't do no face, there's literally no line for the others.
The only one I stood in line for was the automaton from Castle in the Sky, because that whole setup inside, that one was
immaculate. Yeah, that one is cool. That one was cool, and it was a little bit separate from the rest. Yeah, that one did have like a slight. We had to wait in line for like 3 minutes or something.
Yeah, it wasn't much
of a
wait. Even though like 20 people, it took less than 10 minutes.
I think some of the stuff that as far as the access to things and them not allowing photos inside, like I really like it from a experience, and then also because if they did allow photos inside, like, we would all still be in line waiting to get in there.
Yeah, hindsight, I get it, because it would just be, and I think it's the better of two evils. If it was an open policy, it would be crawling with the dregs of YouTube content creators trying to get their shot.
Oh yeah,
that would infuriate me. But they also do control the daily intake, right? Like, you have to schedule quite a few months ahead of time when you're going to go. As a foreigner, at least.
Yeah. So, but
they definitely, yeah, the whole park definitely never felt like we were running into lots of people up until the warehouse, because obviously that's the centerpiece. So.
Yeah. I think probably some of the other highlight stuff there was the I probably get the wrong name, but the Gucci-pan, the bakery from Kiki's.
Yeah, we didn't spend a ton of time there because because it's the first place that they kind of funnel you into is the Witch's Village, so we kind of quickly got away from there.
We went there first because we're like, all right, this place is gonna have a line. So the first thing we did is we got in line for the bakery, and we got a whole bunch of stuff there, and it was all really good. Which, you know, it's one of those things there. You had a place like that, you're like, you know, they could get away with having stuff not be great. But it was actually like, hey, this is actually like really good quality baked goods, which was nice. So, yeah, so I definitely had a good, we had a good time out there. End of the day, we were, you know, tired and done, but it was very cool. And, you know, so different just because with like the no rides, like there was still some crowding and lining and stuff, like inside of Howl's Castle was kind of a mess of people and everything. But I mean, Howl's Castle is kind of a mess of people and everything, and it's, but it's so cool. Just like the tactileness that you can go and grab and pick stuff up and open things. And like out at the, Earth shop at the Hill of Youth, they have Seiji's bike out there, and we went and like put his jacket on, and like when some of the girls in front of us went to go out on the bike, and then one of the people's like, no, you can't ride the bike, and they're like, okay, fair enough, but you're able to sit on the bike and take a picture with the jacket on and stuff. And just
you can play the violin in the workshop. Like, to me, that was a cool
part. Yeah, it's like,
and
oh,
the piano is tuned and playable, like the whole shop, the workshop in general, because like I remember walking in, the first thing you see is the Baron. I'm like, this was what I was waiting for. Like, that was when I really just had this wave of nostalgia rolling, and I'm like, wow, they really nailed the feeling. Because Whispers is my second favorite movie, so that whole area being just so immaculately laid out, and then the tunnel with that goes underneath that has all like the crystals in it and stuff. It's like they integrated so much of the movie in such a small footprint. I was very impressed with that whole section.
Yeah. So that's what I say. I would say if you can get, like, if you can get tickets and make it work, like, go do it. Go stay somewhere in, you know, Nagoya for a day or so.
Yeah,
and like,
there's a day trip from Nagoya. Don't stay in Aichi. There's nothing in Aichi that's worth staying for. Nagoya has a few things. And you can go visit the Toyota Museum. And that's actually, I didn't get to go, but I heard it's really interesting, actually. So.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see. We are coming up on 10-ish minutes left here, and obviously we've covered everything from everyone's trips everywhere. A couple of other things, just a reminder for phones and stuff, if you're doing it, particularly if you're doing iPhone and you're doing a SIM, like I had a 50 gig thing, and I used up like 35 or so. My wife, she did the international plan from Verizon because she needed to keep her phone number. It worked. It got her 20 gigs, and she blew through that and had like a week or so left on low speed, which was frustrating. So just be aware of that, and maybe try to set up to like not have it do. I don't know what took up all the gigs, whether it was just I assume just kind of photos and stuff.
Probably.
Like the cloud syncing of all the photos.
Yeah, it should have done that on Wi-Fi, not the other, but it might have done some of it.
That's true.
And as a reminder, when you go back to the United States, if you're on an iPhone, make sure to go back into your iCloud settings and turn back on iMessage for your phone number when you get back on. Otherwise, you'll be wondering why everything is green bubbles, not blue.
Another pro tip, if you need to keep your phone number but don't want to get an international plan, you can get a Wi-Fi puck, and you can, a lot of phone providers, like I know AT&T does, they provide, actually I think AT&T and Verizon do this, they provide Wi-Fi calling. So you can be in Japan, and as long as you're on Wi-Fi, you can still get calls on your phone number and make calls on your phone number.
Huh. Yeah, I think there's just a multitude of solutions now, because my wife and I were on Google Fi, and Japan is part of their seamless network. So literally when we land, it's like, oh, we see you're in Japan. Would you like to, you know, connect to the local networks here? I just hit yes, and everything worked. And we just stayed on our normal data plan. Well, of course, we used a lot of data when we were there, because we were on maps, like, constantly. But it was completely seamless and didn't require me to get a transponder or a different SIM, which was super nice. It was a little bit pricier probably than if we got a SIM, but just the seamlessness of it and the fact that it was just my phone and my number, like, was super nice.
Also, offline maps is a thing too that I've been doing more. You can, if you know where you're going, pre-download map areas. Not that much space. It's usually like you can get a huge part of Japan for like 600 megs.
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't understand the technology of how they're able to get enough detail in there in such a small thing, but that's a completely aside topic that I'm always amazed at the detail level of like, oh, all of Tokyo. Yeah, sure. It's like 20 megs. And you're like, what?
Other tip, just kind of going a little rapid fire here, is if you're looking for stuff to do, I think in Japan they call them play guides, which is these like e-ticketing sites. And you can go there and put in the dates for your trip, and you can just kind of like, and the regions you're going to go, and you can just go browse around and see what kind of events there are. There's a lot of duplicates just because of the way, depending on the site, how they list them. But like, this is how I found out about the Japan mobility show, basically the auto show.
Oh, yeah, where you got the shot of the Motokompu.
Yeah, yeah. So like I recommend doing that if you aren't sure, like if you're just looking for stuff to do in any random place. It's not a huge amount of stuff, but like it's a good way to stumble on some gems potentially.
I think I literally saw someone like on a motocomp or some sort of comparable thing driving around in Tokyo. I was like, what the heck? That literally looks like a motocomp. on that, like we were out in Shibuya and I randomly saw a poster with Yasuhiko Yoshikazu's art on it. I'm like, oh, what's this? And saw that he was having a museum exhibit at a museum in Shibuya. So I was like, I want to do that. Went there next day. It was one of my top few things that I did on the entire trip. One, just kind of finding it and then going there, and it was so incredible. They had like all of his original sketch artwork for the animation from like Gundam movies. They had the original art for like all of the Gundam poster art, like without anything on it. And then like the poster version of it. And they also had alternate versions of stuff that he'd done. And then they had all of his stuff from like his 25 years of manga art, where you see the original stuff and you literally like see the weight and the impression of the pen and the thickness of everything there. It was such a cool thing there, and they had a board out front with a ton of industry people that have come by and, you know, said, hey man, this is cool, you're the best, including fools like Ono, and I took a picture, there's like every single other person that ever has any appreciation for anything knows that Yas is literally the best.
I mean, anybody in industry has to have some exposure and influence from Gundam, right? Like, it's one of the pillars of anime, so yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And like, beyond that, I don't think I realized it, but he's the one who animated and drew basically the entire ending sequence from Yamamoto. Yeah, that's where he got promoted, just more and more there. They're like, your work is so good, such that they had him do like the key work for the end of the Yamamoto movie. He did like the entire
Yamato?
Yeah. Sorry, okay. Yamato. Yeah. Space Battleship Yamato. Yeah. He did like the entire ending sequence for it. Yeah, and then all of his manga, he has done so much incredible manga work too, because basically after was it Arion came out in 89, he was like, I need a break from anime, and then he just went and did manga for like 25 years. And his manga work is fabulous too. So anyways, yeah, so there's always something crazy like that to go see.
Dude, the gallery stuff is definitely highly encouraged, especially if you can see original like artwork and not like reproductions. I went to Ukiyo-e Museum in Matsumoto, and it was mind-blowing seeing that stuff like in person, just being able to see impressions, like, yeah, like especially at the woodblock prints, you can see like wood grain and the print and like the different layers and all that stuff. Like, it just it adds a whole new level to see that kind of stuff in person, any medium, really.
For sure. Like, just Japanese artisanship in general, in all its forms, it's just like so immaculate. And watching videos of it just really does not do it justice. Like, really being there and experiencing and seeing it as firsthand is definitely a big part of it. Totally agree.
Okay, so I think we're wrapping up here. So I have a game that I want you to play.
Oh,
guess,
boy.
Between myself and my wife, guess how many photos we took in Japan. Oh, we were there three and a half weeks. I have a number.
I'll throw out a nice round 1,000 just to get things going.
Okay.
I'm going to say 720.
Okay.
It's probably way more than that.
I'm going to go above Mike. I'm going to say like a little over 1,000, maybe 1,200.
Okay. So I took 1,285.
Oh my,
my wife took a few more at 12,104. So you guys were a little bit under, because we ended up at a
1,000.
Yes, yeah, so we ended up at around 13,400 photos.
Wait, we got to do the math here. So you were there for how many days?
3 weeks. Sorry.
From yeah, what's the burn rate on that? From when did we get there? I think we got there on November 14th, and we left on the 7th.
That's like over 600 photos a day between the two of you.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
What, is this like burst mode? Like what?
No. I mean, sometimes it was like, and so she did go through and actually deleted. She did go through and cleaned up, and she actually was able to. I was very, very proud of the work that she did. She, what did she say in the end? She finally finished going through. So she deleted 8,300 and kept 3,780 in the first pass.
That's actually a reasonable return.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Cut
off, oh yeah,
yeah,
I agree.
Was this her first time in Japan? Yeah.
Yes.
That explains it for sure. Yeah.
Yes.
There's it's just sensory overload, and just everything looks new and shiny. So yeah, I get it.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh, I want to take a photo. Wait, what if that one's not good? Oh, wait, hang on. No. And then there was stuff like we went out to Yakushima, which is the has like the Mononoke Forest trail on it, which was insane, and you're just like, every 3 seconds she's like, no, stop, I need to take a photo. No, wait, what the heck, this is so crazy, wait, stop, I need to take a photo, wait, no, I need to take a photo. So so you guys are all way the heck under. I'll have to tell her how far under you guys were.
Yeah,
I mean, well, I think if I took the sum total of your guesses, you're not that far off of how many we ended up keeping.
Oh, was it 1,200, 1,000, and 720? So,
so it was something. Yeah, we kept, I think in the end, right now, we've probably kept something like, with mine, something around probably 4,500 pictures. All right. Any other questions, commas, anything for now?
No. No, not nothing to squeeze in here.
I guess from coming from the perspective of you know, obviously being American, and Japan just being a good deal right now. Was there anything you did or anything you ate or anything active you did where the price actually surprised you at how expensive it was?
I think the one thing we went out to, like a super fancy omakase sushi dinner thing, and the waters there were ridiculously expensive. They were like 3,500 yen for a bottle of sparkling water or something there, and we didn't realize. So that was probably the only thing that was like, we're like, oh, we weren't expecting that to be that much. We're like, why was that that much? We're like, oh, why the heck the water was that much? Yeah, well, that's,
I think,
okay.
In general, like beverages and restaurants are actually quite pricey there.
Yeah,
relative to everything else.
I had that when I had my ryokan experience. When I was like, they're like, "What do you want to drink?" I was like, "Eh, sure, I'll get some tea." And they bring me a bottle of tea, and yeah, it was like $6 or whatever. Like, okay, I kind of thought it would be free.
I think that's the only thing that kind of comes to my head as being like something we were not expecting to be, that ended up being a little bit more than we were thinking it was going to be, which is kind of like, eh, it was fine. It was already an expensive
meal. I mean, how
meal,
much, but... about to say, how much was the rest of that omakase dinner?
That one was like, I think that one was, I'm trying to think in US. I think total for the two of us with the sake pairing was something like $500 US for the two of us.
Oh yeah, that's definitely up there.
Yep. It was really cool though. It was this really, it was just like the chef and stuff out there with like 8 seats. You have to be there, you know, be there no earlier than 10 minutes before the thing and no later than 5 minutes before the start of the time, because it's all very regimented out. And it was out in kind of this little neighborhood part out in Nakameguro, out in the slightly kind of southwesternish side of Tokyo. Another just one of those places you go through and you're like, oh man, this is just like a lovely place. So I think it was an expensive meal. We knew it was like our last meal there. We were going out on a big summer blowout.
Yeah, I mean, it overall for like nice omakase, it seems about in the ballpark of what I would expect.
Yeah. It definitely was. It was like, yep.
One last thing before we wrap up. I did remember one reason to go to Akiba is the milk stand in Tokyo, in the JR station. That's cool and unique. Go do that.
What is it?
There's a milk stand in, I think it's on the platform for the Joban Sen. It's just a stand. They sell bottles of milk. You buy the milk. They take the cap off. You drink it there. You give them the bottle back. And they got milk from all over Japan there. It's really cool.
Huh. That is kind of cool.
Interesting.
So you just take the stop there, scan, yep, take the picture of the giant Evangelion art that's out there, and then move on.
Yep. Get your milk. Drink your milk.
Yeah, get your milk. Right.
And then get back on the train and go wherever you're going.
Noted. Okay.
So, all right. So I think then,
And with we that, have just absolutely disgusted everyone more than a few years younger than us by talking about adults drinking milk.
Okay.
Is that a thing?
I don't know why, but it seems to be, I think it's because of all of the non-dairy milks that people grow up with now that the thought of an adult just drinking normal cow milk seems weird to people.
People don't know, like, greatness till they've had coffee milk, though.
They had bottled coffee milk. That's what I got.
Coffee milk is amazing.
Yeah, and it's a distinctly Japanese. Yeah, I'm looking at the pictures of it. It's, like, literally the stuff you get at, like, at bathhouses. Like, it's literally the same thing.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
I mean, I've had coffee milk made in Hanford, but, you know, that's being Central Coast of California thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So with that, I will say thanks for listening, and until next time, this is Amo Kenzoku saying Saraba.